Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through the Greek Mythos section of Deities and Demigods, and while I am enjoying it, it does sometimes feel as though it will never end. We are still only on H, and H is where we are going to stay. In fact, we're not even going to get out of HE, as today we talk about Hecate, the Hecaton Cares, and Hephaestus. Now, I said Hecate there. I always grew up saying Hecate, and looking at the pronunciation, it seems like it should actually probably be Hecate. Again, I don't speak ancient Greek, but I think that's probably right, but I'm probably going to wind up saying Hecate anyway, because that's just what I'm used to. Also, I probably mispronounced Hecaton Care or Hecaton Care or Kyre. I don't really know. Anyway, let's start with Hecate. This is an interesting example of a Greek deity who winds up in popular culture and in the media, but kind of outside the context within which one normally sees Greek mythology. So normally, if you're, you know, watching a film or reading a book or something that has Greek mythology in it, they're going for a kind of, you know, that sort of pseudo-classical aesthetic or something kind of in line with like Greek tragedy. So very dignified and lots of robes and laurel wreaths on people's brows and columns and so forth. The gods on cloud-wreathed Olympus looking down to decide the fate of mortals. That sort of thing. That's not, I don't think, how Hecate, usually appears in popular media. There she appears as, you know, a dark figure, a patron of witches and sorcerers. And that is, I think, not inconsistent with how she is portrayed in Greek mythology. It's just interesting that modern, or at least post-classical writers, interpret that as a reason to kind of keep her separated from the rest of the gods, suggesting that maybe our aesthetic understanding of Greek mythology is a little narrower than the contemporary one. She's quite a complex and important deity. She is, like I said, a patroness of witches and sorcerers. Her brief includes magic, but also night. Crossroads are particularly sacred to her, and she's sometimes depicted as having three faces, or indeed being three people, and sometimes she's represented as an animal or with animal parts, so like as a dog, a snake or a horse, or even a cow or a boar. She's often accompanied by a dog, and a dog accompanies her, a hellhound technically, accompanies her in the illustration here in Deities and Demigods. And I have to say, you know, if you have your copy of Deities and Demigods, go and check out that Hecate illustration, because it is, I don't want to be absolute, but it might be the 70s-est illustration in this entire book. It is very of its time. Like, the way in which it chooses to portray Hecate is definitely, you could imagine it being on the cover of some, like, sensational paperback about witchcraft. Not one of the ones that tries to get everybody all exercised about some imaginary conspiracy of witches, but one of the ones that wants to, like, tell you all about this curious modern religion as a guise to show you some sexy ladies in filmy dresses. Very 70s-y. I mean, this is quite a 70s-y text, even though Errol Otis's art in the Cthulhu Mythos section is from the 70s, completely superficially, I'm going to call it 60s-y. Anyway, as a deity associated with night, Hecate has some special nighttime abilities. I'm particularly fond of the one where she can cast two spells around at night. That seems like, I mean, that's quite powerful, but it's very thematic. I like those types of abilities, you know. I hope that when we get to the Arthurian section, which is going to be a long and dull catalog of knights, I hope that when we get to the Arthurian section, I mean, I'll try not to make it dull, but we'll see that Sir Gawain has his fairy strength where he's stronger when the sun is high in the sky. But although Hecate is associated with the night and with dark and sinister places, part of her function is as a guide through those dark and sinister places. We've seen this already when we talked about Demeter, because when Demeter is searching all across the face of the earth for her kidnapped daughter Persephone, it's Hecate who appears to her. Hecate is often depicted holding a torch, or torches, often two torches, one in each hand. I like that. I think that's a very good kind of mission statement for a cleric, or possibly druid, associated with Hecate, right? To guide people in dark places. That's nice. I like that. And the implication being that she is capable of guiding people in dark places because she sort of belongs in those dark places herself. Descriptions of her in the textual sources are varied. So she's given, you know, a lot of praising epithets. So Hecate, nurse of children, Hecate that holds the keys, Hecate, the only begotten maiden, torch-bearing Hecate, Hecate of the earth, Hecate of the underworld, Hecate apotropaia, so Hecate that turns away. That is specifically, if we say that something is apotropaic, that means it's like a gesture or an amulet or something that's intended to ward off evil. So once again, Hecate's magic is maybe dark and sinister, but it also has a protective function. It keeps away the dark things that are out there. But also we're told that she surpassed her father in boldness and lawlessness. Unfortunately, I don't know if this is a particularly signal achievement, since her father is not really one of those terribly important figures in Greek mythology. He's Perseus, he's a titan. And his name may come from a word that means something like to destroy. So I guess in that sense, he sounds quite formidable, but other than that, he's not. You know, he's certainly, the important thing about him is that he's Hecate's father. One of the challenges, I think, for incorporating a deity like Hecate into a Dungeons & Dragons game is that she's a patron specifically of magic. And we are therefore to understand that there is a distinction between magic and what the rest of the gods do, right? So when Ares strengthens someone's limbs or Athena whisks someone out of danger, that's not magic. Even when those gods bless their followers with abilities that seem supernatural, that's not quite the same thing to the Greek mindset as magic. And that is not how role-playing games in general, and Dungeons & Dragons in particular, handle these types of things. So, in a system that has relatively clear distinctions between divine and arcane, or, you know, cleric and magic user magic, it's weird to have a goddess who is a patroness of sorcerers, witches, people who would be casting what would be understood to be arcane, that is, secret magic. Magic that is not available, you know, just by prayer, but that involves some kind of initiation. I don't have a solution for this problem. It's just the case. I feel like I had this conversation about Odin, right, who teaches magic. Anyway, Hecate is pretty great, and I really like the idea of the cleric of Hecate as the guide in dark places. Like, you're going to go to places that seem strange and sinister to you, and they are. And you're going to encounter things that seem dangerous to you, and they are. But if you listen to me, we might be able to get out of here alive. That's a fun pitch. I like that. Next up, we have the Hecaton Cares or Kyres. I should have looked this up before I recorded. I apologize. Anyway, the hundred-handed ones, and they are giants, and they have 100 arms, as you might expect, which they use to fight with 50 swords and 50 shields, and they got 50 heads apiece. They are traditionally named Gyges, Cottus, and Briareus, although there are other names that they're sometimes known by. They are the children of Uranos and Gaia, and they are another one of those monstrous groups released by Zeus as part of the war against Cronus. They were imprisoned, and Zeus, in his rebellion against his father, employed some "the enemy of my enemy is my friend" type of logic and released them along with, like, the Cyclopes. And after the Titanomachy was over, they were set to be the jailers of the Titans, to watch over them. And I think there's nothing too exciting about Cottus, Briareus, and Gyges specifically, but the idea of that ancient evil released by the gods in a bygone age to fight an even greater evil, I think that's got merit, you know? I think that's got some legs to it. Someone will be praying to their god and they'll be like, "Oh, my lord, I have a question." "Yes, yes, my faithful one. Why is it that you have released the Demogorgon from the lightless abyss to which he was confined? How could you, a good god, have done such a dreadful thing?" And your god says, "If you think Demogorgon's bad, you should see Cthulhu."
I mean, our back was against the wall here, buddy. I don't mind telling you.
I mean, maybe not in those exact words. Once again, I'm going to read from the translation of Hesiod's Theogony by Dorothea Wender. And there's some peculiar stuff about the Hecaton garrison here. So anyway, this is what it says. When Uranos was angry with his sons, Cotos, Gyges, and Briareus. Gyges sometimes called Gyges. At first he bound them up in cruel bonds, because he envied them their looks and size. Looks, again, 50 heads, which, you know. And overwhelming masculinity. He made them live beneath the broad-pathed earth, and there they suffered, living underground. Farthest away, at great earth's edge, they grieved for many years with great pain in their hearts. The son of Cronos and the other gods whom fair-haired Rhea bore to Cronos took Gaia's advice and brought them back to light. She told them everything. The gods would gain glorious pride and victory with the help of those whom they had saved, for Cronos' sons had long been fighting, laboring in pain against the Titans in a violent war. From tall Mount Othrys came the Titan lords, and from Olympus those who give us all, whom fair-haired Rhea bore after she lay with Cronos. They had anger in their hearts, and fought continually for 10 full years, with no release nor end to the harsh strife for either side. The winning of the war was balanced evenly between the two. But when the sons of Uranos received fittingly nectar and ambrosia, which the gods themselves consumed, their spirits rose proud in their breasts, and then the father of gods and men spoke to them. Hear me, glorious sons of Uranos and Gaia, while I speak as my heart tells me to. For many years the sons of Cronos and the Titan gods have been at war, fighting for victory and power. Come now, show them your great strength, your unapproachable hands in painful war against the Titans. And do not forget our kindness and goodwill, how through our plans you come back, having suffered to the light, from gloomy darkness and from painful bonds. He spoke. And blameless Cotos answered him, You do not need to tell us what we know. We know your mind and thoughts are excellent, and that you keep the gods from chilly harm. O Lord and Son of Cronos, we came back from gloomy darkness and from cruel bonds because of your intelligence. We find an unexpected end to suffering. Now with our minds intent and eager hearts, we will preserve your power in dreadful war against the Titans on the battlefield. He spoke, and all the gods, givers of gifts, applauded him, and lusted for the fight even more than before, and on that day they joined in hateful battle, all of them, both male and female, Titan gods, and those whom Cronos sired, and those whom Zeus had brought to light from Erebus beneath the earth, strange, mighty ones, whose power was immense, each with 100 arms darting about, and each had 50 heads standing upon his shoulders over the crowded mass of arms. They stood against the Titans in the grim battle, with giant rocks in their strong hands, while on their side the Titans eagerly strengthened their ranks, and both at once displayed the mightiest efforts which their hands could make. The boundless sea roared terribly around, the great earth rumbled, and broad heaven groaned, shaken, and tall Olympus was disturbed down to its roots when the immortals charged. And so on and so on. And then it goes on to say, Among those gods who made the fighting harsh, foremost were Cotos and Briareus and Gyges, who loved war insatiably. With their strong hands they hurled 300 rocks in quick succession. With their missiles they overshadowed the Titans, put them down in everlasting shade. Under the earth broad path they sent them, and they bound them up in painful chains. Proud though the Titans were, they were defeated by those hands, and sent to misty Tartarus, as far beneath the earth as earth is far beneath the heavens. An anvil made of bronze, falling from heaven, would fall 9 nights and days, and on the 10th would reach the earth. And if the anvil fell from earth, would fall again 9 nights and days, and come to Tartarus upon the 10th. A wall of bronze runs around Tartarus, and round this runs a necklace triple thick of purest night, while up above there grow the roots of earth and of the barren sea. There in the misty dark, the Titan gods are hidden in a mouldering place, lowest and last of giant earth, by the will of Zeus who drives the clouds, and they may never leave. Poseidon set bronze gates upon the place, and all around it runs the wall. There live Gyges, Cotos, and Briareus, as faithful guards for aegis-bearing Zeus. It's a pretty good description of Tartarus, actually, I gotta say. And there in order are the ends and springs of gloomy earth and misty Tartarus, and of the barren sea and starry heaven, murky and awful, loathed by the very gods. There is the yawning mouth of hell, and if a man should find himself inside the gates, he would not reach the bottom for a year. Gust after savage gust would carry him now here, now there. Even the deathless gods find this an awesome mystery. All right. So look, at some point, you're going to have to pull a reverse Zeus in your Greek mythology campaign. You're going to have to go down to Tartarus to get something from the Titans. And while you're down there, you're going to have to contend with Kontos, Gyges, and Briareus. They make a big deal out of the rock-throwing thing, which is pretty good. Is this where the idea of giants hurling rocks comes from? I mean, it's a pretty early source. I didn't expect to like these guys as much as I do, but maybe just because I like Tartarus, but they got some pretty good description there. Finally, we have Hephaestus, the smith of the gods. Look, if you want to go to a divine patron for a magic item, I mean, Hephaestus should be your first stop. He's the classic. He's a bit complex. I said that Zeus was the king of the gods for a culture that had some pretty ambivalent views on kings. And Ares is the god of war for a culture that's got some pretty ambivalent views about war. And Hephaestus is a god of technology for a culture that's got some pretty ambivalent views about technology, or at least about technologists. It's hard not to read this through modern eyes. It's hard not to think of Hephaestus as the bullied nerd of Olympus, but I don't think that's right. And sometimes he's meant to be a ferocious figure, and sometimes he's meant to be absurd. I think that's pretty common in a lot of Greek mythology, right? We're just not. I was talking to friend of the show, Patreon backer, and the DM of my D&D game, Bob, earlier today, and we were talking about the different versions of deities that appear in myths. And I made a comparison to the apocryphal gospels and medieval sort of like folk tales about Christ and how they clearly don't represent the Christ of the Gospels, but, you know, maybe believers aren't necessarily confounded by having two irreconcilable stories about their deity. And what I had been about to say, but then held back, like changed my analogy because I thought it was sacrilegious, maybe, was about Batman, which is to say that I am not perplexed by the fact that the 1966 Batman TV show and the Christopher Nolan Batman movies and Batman comics and whatever, you know, the Arkham Asylum video games, they're all obviously about the same character, and yet also they're not, right? And I don't have to prefer one of those Batman to another, and I don't have to insist that one of those Batman is real and the other isn't. And if we absolutely have to get theological, I will say that the god is so great that he just encompasses contradictions. He's large. He contains multitudes. But I don't know that I do necessarily. I don't know if the apparent contradiction is more than apparent. Hephaestus's epithets are pretty much what you'd expect. He's the coppersmith, the artificer, crafty Hephaestus, Hephaestus the lame one. He creates treasures, he creates magic weapons, all the weapons of the gods except the ones that were created by the Cyclopes. He got some Cyclopes to work with him, which I presume is why, like, his forge attendants are Cyclopes, which I guess is why one of the types of Cyclops in the Deities and Demigods section was created by Hephaestus. He makes sort of automata. His tripods can, like, walk around, which is kind of neat. You know, a bit like Ares, he invites negative comparison to Athena. There is, of course, a myth in which he attempts to rape Athena. I don't know if this is meant necessarily to reflect poorly on Hephaestus's character or just on Hephaestus's, like, relative status with Athena. Greek mythology in general does not show, like, a consistent disapproval of rape, to put it mildly. So on the one hand, his inventions are impressive. He's the god of volcanoes, and this is a culture that is well aware of what a volcano is and what a volcano does. But at the same time, he's a little bit ridiculous. He's married to Aphrodite, and this is understood to be something that Aphrodite is justifiably unhappy about, because he's a blacksmith, he works in his forge, so he's sweaty, and he's dirty. And of course, he's got a bad leg. And this, again, is a culture that has pretty negative views of bodies that don't live up to certain ideals. And I think this is all very interesting. I don't know that this is how the mythology presents him, necessarily. But if I were going to run a cleric of Hephaestus, I think what I would do would be to focus on that idea of ugly necessity. It's not Hephaestus's fault that he doesn't live up to, you know, he doesn't look like Apollo. Depending on the myth that you choose, either he was born that way, or he was cast out of Olympus for attempting to defend his mother from Zeus, and that's how he hurt his foot. You know, there's two versions of the story. But in either way, you know, he is blameless in that respect. It's just that this is not a culture that cares as much about, like, guilt and responsibility as we do. In essence, I would go with the idea of ugly necessity, right? Like, Hephaestus is dirty because he works in the forge. You need people who work in the forge. You just don't like to hang out with them because they're dirty and sweaty and smelly, and that's because you're a hypocrite. Aphrodite cheats on Hephaestus with Ares because Ares is, you know, a big buff macho type. What did Ares ever do? Nothing. Less than nothing. I play Hephaestus as a deity who is disillusioned about Olympus and its values. Now, in order to do that, you might have to throw out the rape episode. To be perfectly honest, if I had to run a game with a sort of pseudo-Greek pantheon, the first thing I would do is take a big pair of scissors to all of this rape. I just don't know that it fits the aesthetic you're almost certainly going for if you decide to do an ancient Greek game, to say nothing of, you know, how players might react to it. But so, stipulating that we, you know, we are shaping Hephaestus into the most D&D-able version of Hephaestus, I like the ugly, hard-headed, ruthless, like pragmatism and ruthlessness are two sides of the same coin, right? You say, I'm a ruthless dirtbag who would feed your grandmother to a tiger if I thought it would help me achieve my goals. I say, I'm mission-oriented. And I think Hephaestus works there. This is the god that can't help but get dirty, literally and metaphorically. Pretty boys want their golden bows, and they don't want to hang out with the people who make the golden bows. And the people who make the golden bows are just gonna have to find a way to be okay with that. Conceptually, I always really enjoy these roughneck characters, and I never find that I'm actually all that good at playing them. I've had several characters in a row now that I've been playing who are like gruff and hostile and not likable, and it's not really me. I like to play charmers. These crusty guys are starting to get me down. Anyway, I think that's where I'd take the Hephaestus thing. And that would explain why society has such an ambiguous view of Hephaestus, because no one likes to be confronted with their own hypocrisy. Like, we all have that impulse to recoil when we see the dirty, sweaty blacksmith in the forge, because he's ugly and he smells bad, and we all recognize at some level that there's something ignoble about that impulse. I don't know that that's present in the text. I think I just made that up, but it's also good if the player characters ever have to go get, like, a magic whatever from Hephaestus, and they get to go to his forge, and there's his Cyclops assistants, Arges, Brontes, and Steropes, and there he is hammering away, and he knows exactly what you want. You want a magic thunderbolt or something. And he'll make it. That's what he does. But he's gonna make sure that you are unable to maintain your aloof detachment from him and people like him if he's gonna make it for you. That's a fun Hephaestus. I don't think it's a mythological Hephaestus, but I think it works. Alright, anyway, that's about all the time that we have for today. In our next episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through, again, not just the Greek mythos section, but still the H section, as we talk about Hera, Heracles, and Hermes, all right here on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.